Donald Dean had no idea at all that things had gone other than successfully at the other mine sites, or that they'd succeeded at the compound. He got back into his flight clothes. No hurry. He took his time. What a busy night it had been. His and Dwight's plan had been to bring the chiefs across the sea to celebrate the victory. They had landed both ships on a flat place 2 miles off so as not to shock the people, and he had borrowed a horse from a startled farmer he had known and ridden in. He had gotten his uncle, chief of Clan Fergus, out of bed, and Gillies had flown to light the fires on the hills to gather the clans to hear the news. The mine site in Cornwall was no more. They would be free to roam the whole of England. The chief was very fond of his nephew, Donald Dean, who was, in fact, his heir. He liked Donald Dean's style, a true Scot. He had listened enraptured as Donald Dean had given him a thumbnail but torrential account of all their doings. And if Donald Dean were a bit incautious, the chief gave his attention while making very sure to reserve judgment and act in a wise way, on the general scene, without spoiling Donald Dean's flair. So he had ordered the beacons lighted. He was cautiously thrilled. Donald Dean had then gone to see a lass and had asked her to marry him, and she had said,
"Oh, yes, oh, yes, oh, yes, Donald Dean."
That attended to, he had come home for a nice snooze. Biddy seemed to be trying to remember something else. He was hopping from one bare foot to the other, squinting up his eyes, wiping at his nose. Then the boy seemed to abandon his effort. Donald Dean was almost dressed. The boy's eyes caught the sword on the wall. It was a claymore used in battles and for ceremony. It was a real claymore, 5 feet long, not just a basket hilt saber. Biddy was gesturing at it, indicating the prince should wear it. Donald Dean shook his head to signify no, he wasn't going to take it this time. When he saw the eagerness die in Biddy's eyes, Donald Dean relented. He took it down and handed it to him.
"All right, but you carry it."
The sword was a foot taller than the boy. Worship, awe, and joy sprang up in the boy again as he draped the hanger around his neck. Donald Dean checked his gear and went out. The castle passages and halls were aswarm with gillies. They had Lochaber axes in their belts and were bustling around with 100 chores in preparation for a gathering of the clans. Donald Dean had really thrown a firebrand into the scene. Nobody had been briefed. They didn't know what was going on. Donald Dean had come home. Orders had been given. Somebody said the Cyclo mine site was no more. There was an awful lot to do. The ancient ruin had remained a ruin above ground so as to attract minimal attention from drones that had gone over for centuries. Some said the place had once been the seat of Scottish kings. Its dungeons had been expanded, and it was a fortress in itself. 2 gillies had Donald Dean's own horse saddled, and it was prancing about. The gillies were smiling broad welcomes to Donald Dean. He mounted, and at a signal they tossed the boy up behind him, Clechamore and all. It was raining. A storm apparently had moved in. It had been clear when they landed, but now the dawn was thick with overcast. It was at that moment that Biddy MacLeod remembered the rest of the message.
"Your squire," he said to Donald Dean's back, "also say to squiggle?"
The boy's accent was thick, not the accent of an educated Scot.
"To what?" demanded Donald Dean.
"I misremembered. I couldna think of the word," apologized the boy. "But it did sound like squiggle."
"Scramble?" asked Donald Dean,
the word that meant emergency takeoff.
"Ah, so 'twas, so 'twas."
Donald Dean was off like a shot, and 2 miles were never eaten up so fast by a horse. They came plunging to a stop on the flat-topped knoll. Donald Dean looked wildly about. Only the passenger plane was there. He flung himself off the horse and flung the reins to the boy. He opened the door and leaped into the passenger plane, reaching for the radio. And then Dwight landed nearby, startling the horse into frantic plunging that lifted the boy and the sword off the ground at every rear. Donald Dean raced over to Dwight. It's gone now, said Dwight. There had been no radio messages from the compound. Dwight, as arranged, had faithfully stayed on watch. He had waited for any break in radio silence, and the end of the silence itself. The time period had ended, but pilots, not hearing from the compound, and Robert the Fox had not opened up. But something else peculiar had happened. Dwight had picked up a cyclo conversation on the planetary plane band, very loud and clear. It seemed loud enough to be within 1,000 miles or so, maybe more, hard to tell.
What did they see? Demanded Dunaldine.
I got it all on a disc, said Dwight.
He started the disc. It said,
Nup, you crap brain, wake up!
Dwight said he had at once sent the boy to tell Dunaldine to scramble, and then he himself had gone straight up. Yes, the sudden roar of Dwight's own engines was there on the disc. The disc played on.
Drone, said Dunaldine. Zut. That was a transport chief named Zut.
Well, he was out there someplace in a drone, said Dwight.
He had gone up as high as he could, about 200,000 feet, as fast as he could go.
Almost tore my heart and lungs out with gravity, said Dwight.
Then he heard complete instructions in cyclo about re-landing on top of a drone in front of a door so Zut could get out of the drone.
There is no drone that big, said Dunaldine. Not that I know of.
Dwight had turned on every search instrument he had. The transmission had been coming from the northwest. He had sped in that direction. He had gotten it on his scope. It was traveling 302 miles per hour. A very positive blip. It was clear weather where the thing had been. This cloud cover and rain was ahead of it. He played some more transmission. Somebody named Snit was still in the drone, but no explanation why. This was mad, because drones didn't have pilots. But how could anybody fly anybody out of a drone? And then somebody was taking fuel out of the drone in an ore basket, and the other cyclo said he was leaving the drone.
Then why are you here?
Demanded Dunaldine, turning toward the passenger plane.
Why didn't you attack it?
It blew up, said Dwight. I saw it visual, eyeball. It looked like 30 lightning storms. It curved down. It probably went into the sea. I scanned the whole area. There was a little blip left. Probably when it sank, it had some debris. And then that was gone. It just isn't out there anymore on any scope. So I came back here.
Dunaldine played the disc through again. Dunaldine pulled out the instrument recorders. They told the same story. Heat and then gone. Dunaldine looked at the sky.
You better go back up there and patrol in that direction.
There won't be any blip, said Dwight. And this overcast is high. The thing was flying at about 5,000 feet... and you won't be able to see a thing visually. The overcast goes up to at least 10. There's no blip, finished Dwight.
Dunaldine turned and looked at the castle ruin, gaunt and very old in the morning rain and mist. 2 miles away, and it was drifting in and out of visibility. What was that all about? Had the battle of the compound been lost? What drone? And why had it blown up? The clan chiefs would be assembling, and he had a lot of things to do today. 5. Johnny drifted up out of a pit of black pain. He tried to orient himself. The drone motors were like shouting anger in his ears. His arms were hanging down into a gap in the floor plating. Blood had run along the sleeves and dried. With a start of alarm, he thought of Zut and reached for the revolver. It was gone. The lanyard snapped in the blast. The blast? Zut was also gone, and so was the Mark 32. And so was anything that would let this ancient monster be located on a screen. He lifted himself up with considerable effort. He was still tied with the safety line. He found it very hard to think connectedly, and he wondered for a bit why he was tied to the line. His back hurt, one more pain in a confused welter of it. He realized the safety line had pulled him back inside. It was awfully hard to think, and he recognized that he was getting worse, not better. He was nauseated. Hunger. It must be that he was nauseated from hunger. He got to his knees. The drone was no longer rolling. That was a relief. He turned and then stared. Through the door, bright tendrils of mist and fog were curling in. It was a storm. He was flying through a storm. Wait. It was light out there. Daylight. Well advanced daylight. How long had he been out? It must be hours. He spun on his knees, thinking to see the gas canisters dropping gas. He had no way to tell that. Were they already past Scotland? Had the drone already done part of its work? He got to the door and tried to spot a brighter area in the storm that might tell him where the sun was. It was too thick. He wasn't thinking well. He realized he had reverted to being a mountain man. There were compasses in the plane. He opened the door and saw the havoc Zut had made with the radio smash-up. It distracted him. Then he realized he had opened the door to look at the compasses and did so. When he leaned over, it felt like somebody was hitting his skull with a sledgehammer. He felt for the compress on his head. It was still there. No, the compasses. Look at the compasses. He was heading southeast. The course to Scotland would have curved over like that. He couldn't be sure. He went back to the door and tried to look down. He nearly fell. He couldn't see anything down there. All rain and mist. Then he remembered the ship had gas ports in the bottom. He crawled painfully to the floor plate he had removed and looked past the motor housings. No daylight was coming up. His air mask seemed to be suffocating him. He recalled it had been askew when he woke. Of course. The drone had dropped no gas yet. He'd be dead. Well, he wasn't dead. Pretty well on the way to it with this head, but he wasn't dead. Therefore, the drone had not yet dropped gas. Part of his trouble was that his air bottle was out of air. He got new bottles and put them in place. It made him feel a little less lethargic. He got a grip on himself. He was just dawdling around. What had he been at when he had been hit with whatever it was? Maybe he didn't have very much time. His industry faded when he recognized he didn't have the wrench anymore. He made himself think, to come out of his pain. He climbed down and checked the nuts on the inspection plate. They were loose, but it would take an age to unscrew each one. The threads were too many. He got into the plane and rummaged about. He found a bag of explosives and emptied it. He had 6 limpet mines, a long coil of blasting cord, some boxes of blasting caps. He looked for time fuses. None. He looked at the limpet mines. No time fuses, only contact buttons that would explode them when heavily jarred. No electrical cord. It was an awful effort to think, to concentrate on just one thing. What could he do with this mess? Straight contact? Suicide stuff. He found his own belt pouch, some flints, pieces of glass. Ah, a roll of long buckskin thongs. At least he could get the nuts off. Encouraged, he somehow got down to the inspection plate again. He did a binding wind for the first turn and then wound the thong around and around the nut. He tied a hand loop onto the remaining end. He braced himself and gave a heavy yank. The nut spun off, leaped up, and vanished into the dark hold. Even though the yank had almost torn his head apart, he repeated the action with the other 3 nuts. Gone. He struggled to lift the heavy plate. He had intended to just lay it aside, but it slipped from his gloved fingers and fell into the darkness of the drone's belly. Let it go. Now he was staring into the black interior of the housing. There were some small electrical sparks arcing in there. He knew very well you were not supposed to get into a motor when it was running, and certainly not put a hand to one. It was said it gave a paw a funny feeling like it wasn't there and then was and then wasn't there. One could lose a paw, Kerr had said. He painfully lifted himself to the ship again and found a spare torch and went back and shone the light inside the housing. There were all the thousands of coordinate points jutting out from the inside skin. They were smoothly arcing as they translated progressive space. It wasn't electricity, really. It was energy driven up to the arc point, and then these arc points did a conversion to space coordinates in terms of pure space. The electricity just kept little motors running behind the points. This thing must have thousands of sub-motors behind those points, and they could be damaged. It wasn't armored in there. The light shining into it looked funny. It was appearing and disappearing in a flutter. Well, a blast could wreck those translation motors and the points, flicker or no flicker. A small sub-motor was a small sub-motor, and a blast would disable them. The space converter wouldn't convert anymore, and this thing would simply go unpowered and crash. He didn't think the balance motors could support the mammoth drone by themselves. Yes, it would crash. He drew back. Leaning forward was bringing on the blackness again. He mustn't pass out anymore. That was final. He mustn't pass out anymore. In the plane, he gritted his teeth and stayed conscious. He had to work out a rig. Nothing but contact firing devices. What could he use to detonate them? The plane's guns. He would rig it so he would fire the guns and blow the plane backward out the door. An inspection of the battle plane gun panel revealed no damage. The console was not damaged. He looked at the housings of the plane's main and balance motors. Was that a scrap of wire on the floor? But when he leaned forward to see closer, he started to black out again and stood up. Time. He had better work fast. He might even be too late now and crash this thing in the hills with the gas blowing all over. This nausea was just hunger, that was all. He picked up some dried venison and lifted his mask. But chewing on it was an effort. It made him feel worse. What was he doing? He must concentrate. Not just his mind, but even his actions were wandering. He got a spare safety wire and started to tie the mines together in a long string. They had magnetic grips to hold them to hulls. He had asked for them, thinking he could drop them in a circle on top of the drone and blow an entry hole in. Useless for that, but he would put them to work now. A garland. Chrissy, when she was a little girl, used to make flower garlands and put them on his pony's neck. He was wandering again. He gritted his teeth and kept at his job. The manual had said, "Do not pack mines with contact fuses in such a way that the fuses can be subjected to closure by the weight of another mine." A vision of the cyclo belt buckle, as he had seen it many times on Turl, rose before him. The clouds of gas in the sky. How he hated it. A garland. He had the mines strung. He then took a long length of blast cord and wove it through the holes in the limpet bases that let the mines cling to metal. He hoped they didn't cling. Yards and yards of blast cord looped past the contact of each mine and up parallel with the safety wire. It was all so heavy, so very heavy, he was starting to black out again. He caught himself. He managed to get the long end of the safety cord through an upper I-beam support. Using its friction as a brake, he got the mines suspended over the inspection hole and lowered them carefully down into the housing. Down they went, deeper and deeper. Good thing this drone wasn't rolling or the mines would snap over to cling magnetically to the inside skin of the housing. Careful, careful, lower and lower. There was a sudden jerk. The bottom mine had hit the bottom of the housing interior. Good. No, not so good. Had the drone motor changed pitch, or was that just part of the murky sea of semi-delusion in which he was so slowly moving? Were the mines altering the space contour of the interior and affecting the motor drive? He didn't know. But there was no time. He tied the safety line fast to a beam. The loose long end of the blast cord he threw up over the upper structural bars. Ow, but that hurt his head. Was it in front of the plane's guns? Near enough. He got the blasting caps. Percussion, it said on the box in Cyclo. He started to fasten a single cap on the blast cord directly ahead of his guns. Then, with a burst of finality, he tied the whole box to it. He checked, thinking with difficulty. When he fired the guns, it would set off the caps. These would fire the blast cord, and that would fire the mines. He realized then it would have been smarter to have sealed it with the housing cover. He looked down into the depths. He turned a torch down there. Was it possible to recover the inspection plate cover and its nuts? But he forgot about that. His light was playing straight on the full intake cap. There were two caps. No, five tubes. Into these he knew would be stuffed hundreds of fuel cartridges, dropped in one after the other. A drone like this required an enormous number of cartridges. It must. Waves of nausea and blackness were hitting him. He mustn't tip his head over and look down. That was the secret. He wondered whether those big fuel tube covers would move. They were usually just screwed on. With difficulty, he got down to them. With both hands, he gave one a twist. It spun easily. Within a minute, he had five fuel tubes open, the covers clanging down into the dark belly. For a while, it wouldn't affect the drone, but if the blast fed into those open tubes, oh my. He checked everything again. The drone soared out. But not for long, he told himself grimly.